This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, one and all. Welcome along to the show. It is great to have your company of a Monday evening. Good evening, Alan Cawley. How are you?
I'm great, Shane. How are you?
I'm very well. Very much looking forward to this evening's show as we reflect on a good weekend. Austin O'Malley, how's the fun?
Really good, I have to say now. Yeah, really, really good after the weekend.
Enjoyed yourself in Crow Park?
I absolutely did, yeah. Yeah, it was a brilliant day. Yeah, it was a brilliant day and I thought we got a really, really good contest in many aspects in terms of performance. I think there was just a lot in it. Like, it was a good advertisement for the game.
And I can pose the same question to you. Enjoyed yourself in Crow Park, Alan Cawley?
My Monday night sidekick looked after me, Shane. I wouldn't expect anything else. So I made my way in, yeah. And I did. I really enjoyed it. The game, I know we'll get into it, but it just never... Unbelievable
start.
Did
your expectations, Al?
Well, it was high expectations, man. Yeah.
And the expectations were high, to be fair.
How many Gaelic football championship matches have you been to Crow Park?
Probably last four finals.
Kerry and Donegal fans are 515 over this
that's
man
fair
stealing
no, I was in a hurling matches quarterfinals, semi-finals. No, people know I am a GAA fan.
Yeah.
And I did have expectations, big expectations, but unfortunately they just couldn't grab onto them, Donegal, in fairness, and we'll get into the nuts and bolts of it later on. But it was a really good day and Croke Park looked amazing.
Yeah,
as it always does, I suppose, in All-Ireland final day.
Did the pitch look amazing?
No.
We're the fan of the
yeah,
new
it was an interesting design. Yeah,
less is more.
Yeah, I think so. Even looking back on it, maybe last night, I thought even from a visual, maybe on TV, that it definitely you know, kind of on the eyes, it was a little bit. Yeah, there was a lot going on. It was busy.
I like the ambition to try something.
Well, the writing in the middle was fine.
Yeah.
And it was just the way the grass was cut, I think.
Yeah. There were some great pictures on Twitter of just meow lads after cutting the grass and trying to do all these diamonds and everything else, taking inspiration.
After a few.
Yeah.
Gavin Cooney had a tweet. It was like an ad for Husk Farna or something. So that was a good one, I thought. Yeah.
Right. What did catch your eye over the weekend? Austin O'Malley, are all of your weekend highlights centred around an All-Ireland football final?
Yeah, they actually are. And I suppose leaving Crow Park yesterday evening, and, you know, I know there was an awful lot in the game and there was an awful lot to love in it in terms of individual performances. And there was some stellar performances, like even Clifford and, you know, both Cliffords, you know, really, really shone. But for me, I suppose maybe just with your kind of coaching hat on, I just thought the totality of Kerry's performance, and probably if you wind that back to, I suppose, the engineering that went on maybe to get that out of the guys. I just thought it was incredible. And I suppose a lot of wood needs to land maybe at the feet, of Jack O'Connor. And I think, you know, just to get that out of those guys, a complete 70-minute performance in that arena under that pressure was incredible, given the pressure that they were under, throughout the year and that. And I suppose arguably, it's one of the toughest jobs in GA in terms of wearing the Bannister bib for Kerry, and the expectation is so high. But, you know, he's a guy that we may not see in a Bannister bib again, perhaps patrolling the sideline. So I just think, you know, there's so much in it and in terms of so much to get it right. But they really did get it right in every facet of the game. And I thought it was just a masterclass. And if he does bow out in that, I think it'll be a beautiful way to go.
Do you think he will bow out, or does he smell blood now?
Yeah, it's interesting, and you know, he's very quick with it. And last night, when it was put to him, obviously he said that the wife took a picture of him going out the door Thursday night with the gear bag, and it was going to be framed. So she was setting the terms of reference there. But I Jack has been around a long time, and I'd say if there's any man that could change his wife's mindset, I'd say, you know, and go again. Look, it's incredible what he's achieved. He's three different terms. I think he's five All Irelands won with five leagues across 11 seasons, and I think eight All-Irelands in total, if you throw in minor and 21. That's not to mention Hogan Cup that he's won with schools, Colossian and Skellige, and vocational schools Ireland. Like, he's an unbelievable CV. So if he does walk away, he's nearing, I think, the 65 mark. So he's given a huge amount to Kerry. But just looking at the profile of the team, and, you know, I think with the new rules and everything, and he has so many guys there that are just, you know, coming into what you would say, you know, the real apex of their career, that, like, I wouldn't be surprised if he went again, you know.
Mm. All of that across three different spells, which is just incredible.
It's incredible. And each of those spells have been punctuated with different moments where he's come under serious, serious pressure. And, you know, he has always come up with the answers, and the answers have been in Celtic Crosses. They've delivered. When it's been put to him, he's always found a way to pull performances out of that team. And that's why I just think yesterday, in terms of that, it was almost perfect. I just left Croke Park thinking that was as measured and as controlled and as close to perfection as you could ask for. And the thought that had to go into that and the drilling that had to go into that to get that out of guys, it's exceptional. It's a lot of work goes into that.
So many brilliant individual performances, and I reckon perhaps a highlight of mine over the weekend was probably it's a three-way toss-up for man of the match, I'd imagine. Joe O'Connor, Gavin White and Paddy Clifford, I would say, would be the three options.
Hold on a minute now.
And of course you would agree, Mr. Colley.
Hold on 1 minute now, right? Do you want my highlights and then do you want me to argue this out with you?
I'm just assuming.
Well, my highlight is...
I'm predicting that you're low light.
Glad Austin spent so much time on Jack O'Connor, because that must be mentioned in terms of what he's achieved. Is absolutely... I didn't even realise there was the league, the doubles and all.
Five doubles, in 11 seasons.
Incredible. Yeah. Absolutely. But my highlight, there's only one man to discuss tonight, Shane. And people will go on and all about, oh... And this takes me back to the conversation we had after the semi-final. And the point that was made that we almost take him for granted. To rock up in a final that all the expectation is on you, and to deliver the performance that he did and score 9 points from play, the two-pointers which were the most critical, especially the one on the buzzer at half-time, the point down the,
created the side... Created by Paddy Clifford, but go on.
The point down the side of the Hogan stand where he cut inside on a so-called weaker foot in between the two defenders. And to be fair to Brendan McCall, looking at the match yesterday inside, I was thinking, because I was chatting to this lovely man next to me, and I was thinking, he's not really getting that close to him. It didn't appear that way inside in the ground. Mm. I watched back the highlights last night. He couldn't have been any closer, to be fair to Brendan McCall.
Did you see that clip on Twitter by any chance? It's taken from the stands. It's on, like on a camera phone, basically, where it's shown. It's just before the two-pointer, before the break, basically, where it's just that patience and the build-up, and he's just going at him. He's going at him. Touch tight.
That's incredible.
Like, and the skill level to be able to... As Austin will know, when a fella is close to you, or even giving you the odd little shove, or you say kind of lean into someone to put them off, and he's still able to get the accuracy on the shot, the distance, it's just phenomenal. I'm watching him yesterday, I have to say, and again, I go back to it, and it's not about man of the matches and stuff like that. His bigger accolades will come. But it was phenomenal, his performance. And I know Paddy was brilliant, and I know Gavin White was brilliant, and I know Joe O'Connor was brilliant, and I'd throw Brian O'Biagluck, and I'd throw them all into it. They were all brilliant. But sometimes there's someone that just separates you from the rest. And he is, honestly, Shane, what I watched yesterday, and with the new rules, and we mentioned it here months ago, even I looked at him last year thinking, he could throw this game there. Like, there was doubling up on him, trebling up on him, dragging him, hitting him, punching him, fighting him. Like, to see him in space... And see him in all his glory yesterday and
he's
doing
awesome.
What he does.
It's awesome.
It absolutely is. It's awesome. And I loved watching him every minute, the whole championship. But to do it in the final, 9 points from play, and people not even saying he deserved the man of the match, will you stop?
Is he the greatest ever?
I think he is, personally. Like, from looking at it, I really, really do think he is. And like, when you think of what he has carried, you know, and the pressure that he's carried over the last number of years, and to be within that bubble, and we know, like, as I've said to you earlier about the pressure of the Bannisters, Babe and Kerry, but, like, the expectation that's been on him since he was 15, 16 coming through, and he has continually delivered, and he's delivered right, even in games where Kerry haven't been going well, he has still been going well, and earlier this year as well, and like, he's just absolutely supremely gifted. He's like, and I know Jack O'Connor keeps referencing, but his temperament is uncanny. Like, he's never flustered. He just can, he has that ability to perform under pressure. I mean, Alan, you spoke there about getting those type of shots off and that, like, the pressure that he's been under, he's 6'3", 6'4", to get shots off with that and those big moments.
And that one, Austin, where they were counting down the clock, obviously everybody knew they're counting down the clock, getting ready for trying to score the last point. And he's taking it on his shoulders. He knows, I'm taking this shot. Yeah. He knows that Paddy's soloing around and they're all movement. As you said, that video, Shane, which captures it brilliant, and the patience that he shows. Because it's a good 30, 40 seconds where he's waiting and he's lining up the defender and he's waiting, and he knows, I'm getting this shot and I need to nail it. Mm. And he nails it. Like, it's unbelievable. And they're all running off with that momentum, 7 points up. And like, he was just... And the one thing I love about him, and even looking at his brother last night in the interview, they're so humble. You never hear a word about them.
No.
they came across so lovely in the interview last night. And the biggest thing about the performance yesterday, Shane, and we speak a lot about it, and it drives me insane sometimes, egomaniacs that are involved in sport and they want it all about themselves. He was willing to sacrifice himself for so many minutes yesterday, where he was coming out away from the play and knowing, I just need two little seconds here every so often to nail a point, nail a score. Whereas you'd have other lads who'd be feeling kind of, there's a discipline even in that in itself, where fellas would think, oh, I'm the main man, I need to be on the ball the whole time, I need to do this, I need to do that. And we go back, but even we're joking about the cutting the grass, less is more. He only touched the ball for 7 or 8 times, did he yesterday?
Yeah, he'd actually, he had 13 possessions in totality, and he had 9 scores, which is a huge, huge return. And when you think about that in terms of the leadership, and that would have been well plotted in terms of him, he sat out in that kind of box 10 for so long. But that took, you know, you could see he took Brendan McCall out there, but also if they were trying to get a plus, it was to that side because they were trying to double up on him, so it freed up. But he's got everything. I think he's, you know, if you looked in terms of Kerry football, you know, he's a bit of the bomber. He's got a bit of the gooch. He's got a bit, you know, he's got a bit of all of those together. Like, and I was walking out of Croke Park yesterday, and I was thinking, there was a great quote by you, Michelangelo. He said when he was carving the statue of David, and I thought it was so apt. He said, I seen an angel in the marble, and I just kept carving until I set him free. And I just thought yesterday evening, I thought Clifford was set free, you know, in terms of that. And Kerry have set him free, and it's like I said about Jack O'Connor carving up a game plan, but you know, to create something that does set a guy free like that for 70 minutes, I just think it's incredible. So there'll undoubtedly probably be statues around Kerry of him at some stage. But it just, look, he's incredible. We're so lucky to have him in the game, as we are with others that are leading.
And
the
people should acknowledge that. They shouldn't be taken for granted what he does, I'm telling you, Shane.
Needs to get more Man of the Match awards. So. Yeah.
Well, that's a given.
I do you know what, another thing, the picture of Ogie, David and Paddy holding up there.
That's beautiful.
In like 20 years time, or however many years time, when the young fella is winning more All Ireland, so that's going to be referred back to.
If I was Ogie, I'd leave the Gaelic alone. he's not living up to that.
515-52 is the text number. Paul from Sligo texts in saying, I think Park Harrington deserves a shout. Yes, rightly so. Harrington scoring a senior major number 3 and a first senior open title with the win, becoming the 5th player to add the senior open to an open championship after Darren Clark, Tom Watson, Gary Player and Bob Charles, also the 3rd Irish winner of the event, following on from Clark and Christy O'Connor Jr. Just to mention, actually, golf as well caught my eye, that Anna Foster has qualified for the Women's Open, which starts on Thursday at Royal Portcull in Wales. In today's 18-hole final qualifier, Foster carded a 3 on the par 68 at nearby Pyle and Kenfig. Leona McGuire and Lauren Welsh were already exempt. What else caught your eye over the weekend?
Sligo Rovers. I'm glad Paul texted in there, Paul from Sligo. He must be delighted with Sligo Rovers' result Friday night as well. Keeps the run going, Shane.
What a way to finish. I'm not sure if
there's no better way.
Austin.
There's no better way.
They were 2 down, Sligo were.
And very poor, Shane, it must
be
said.
In the first half. Well. And this is against a Cork side who are fighting to stay up, basically. And I saw Credit to Niall Worthington on Twitter earlier, does a lot of League of Ireland stats, and basically it's a 99.99% chance that Cork are going to get relegated, and it's a 96% chance that Rovers are going to win the league. So he does a lot of stats work on Twitter. So 2 down, 2 all. Then Alex Nolan, I think it was, for Cork City. Unbelievable strike outside of the box, rattles the crossbar, 88 minute. Sligo go down the other end of the pitch. Ryan O'Kane.
Sliding door moment. Like,
but it was a great finish, wasn't it?
No.
But although I did feel, even watching, I know Nolan had the shot, but once they got back to 2-2, it did seem like there was only going to be one winner, Shane. And all the momentum, they were in the ascendancy at that stage. As you say, Cork were kind of out in their field a little bit. I know some of the fans were critical of the manager not making substitutions and stuff. But it just keeps the run going. They've really turned things around. And we mentioned it here. I was actually saying a few weeks ago about maybe catching Waterford. Galway are the ones who need to be looking over their shoulders along with Waterford. But that was a big win for Waterford. But Galway now are only 3 points. Sligo Rovers only 3 points off Galway, Shane. So big weekend for them. Big win. And we'll take care of Shelburne this Saturday in the showground.
Oh, he's throwing the gauntlet down there.
See, Austin, Shelburne are too busy concentrating on European football.
Okay, on the big stuff.
And Shane, if you want to travel to Sligo, I look after you in Sligo this weekend. The way my sidekick looked after me in Croke Park yesterday.
I didn't make it to Baku this week, so I think Sligo will have to make up for it.
We look after you in Sligo if you're coming down.
Speaking of football, actually, the UCD Bowl of a Sunday
on,
is
Shane.
Not for everyone. I do have to give this a mention. I was at the Women's FAI by Amateur Cup. It used to be the Intermediate Cup. It's now the Amateur Cup. Whitehall Rangers defeating Terenure Rangers, who were holders for the last 2 years. In, I have to say, an absolutely cracking game of football. Unbelievable goal in the first minute. Lee McHugh curled one in top corner. Then it was a great match. Really open game of football. Really well refereed as well, because we're always giving referees criticism, particularly in the League of Ireland and even at a lower level as well. So really well refereed. Terenure, as I said, holders last 2 years. They got a penalty in the second half. Lauren Davis, unbelievable save for Whitehall. Saves a rebound to the penalty as well. And then just carnage at the end. Really open game. And Whitehall, new management team this year. So a 1-0 victory for Whitehall Rangers. So yeah, I do have to give that a mention.
Brilliant. Fair play, Shane.
So a really, really good game of football. Really good game of football as well. Sligo's late winner was also on my list. Gillespie, Griffin and Mangan, first Irish women in the Women's Tour de France as well. It's a notable achievement there, so that is good to see. Lowlights, you mentioned you had a low light. Was that...
No, none this week.
No.
None this week. Ultra positive.
Take a pulse check there. Will I?
Ultra positive.
That's what happens when you go to Croke Park. Yeah. You see, you have to get you in there more often. And actually, it raises the spirits. Yeah.
It did.
I have to say, I had it down originally in my highlights, so I go over the weekends and I write in front, Alex Dunn, that's dead on highlight, bang, here we go, and then it just automatically turned into a low light. So he got disqualified. He's been stripped of his victory in the F2 feature race in Belgium after being handed a 10 second penalty. Dunn had qualified on pole position at Spa on Friday. The race was started behind the safety car, so basically he did not engage the start setup procedure at the start of the formation lap, and he was penalised 10 seconds. So it's a low light because he was done so well and he retook in the championship standings and everything. So it was unfortunate. It was unfortunate for Alex Dunn as well. I mentioned we want to hear your highlights. 51552 is a text number. Give a mention to the Irish Downhill Mountain Bike Championships held, now excuse my pronunciation here, the Ballyhoura Mountains over the weekend. Over 200 of Ireland's best downhill bikers, including Oisín O'Callaghan, trying to go two in a row at senior level, and Jacob Dixon's aiming to stop him, competed for 8 national titles from under 14 all the way to senior elite. Hundreds and hundreds of spectators crammed into the County Limerick venue and retreated to an epic, breathtaking day's racing, topped off by local hero Oisín retaining his title as senior national champion for a second year. That's sent in by Sean O'Sullivan. So it's obviously
really tough sport when you see it's
the downhill mountain biking.
Yeah. Crazy, that is.
Like, it's
the speed they get to as well.
It's incredible, yeah. And to be able to stay on board, I always think it's...
Wouldn't be for me, Austin.
You'd be going out over the handlebars.
Wouldn't be for me.
Yeah. Keep it on the deck. Keep it on the deck.
Surfing on Friday wasn't for him, and now downhill bike. Yeah. You're more of a relaxed gentleman, are you, Alan?
I'm selective and I know what I like, Shane. That's
and
okay,
I know what I'm good
it?
At.
Yeah.
And I like the luxuries in life.
This is a man who has the crucible up as one of the greatest sporting events.
It is.
A lot more.
100%.
A lot more chilled, a lot more relaxed. Aren't we lucky that Clifford hasn't been snatched up by the AFL? He could be making serious money, but decided to go to not go when he was a teenager, if my knowledge is correct.
Aren't you lucky he wasn't snapped up by the League of Ireland as well?
That's true, yeah. His centre half.
You mentioned it last night, didn't you?
That's right.
Yeah, he played a bit of soccer.
Yeah, and didn't Joe O'Connor play a bit of rugby as well? And he came late to... the Kerry setup. I think Tomás O'Shea made that kind of joke. It's like, well, let the lads now in Kerry just play the other sports and then blood them into the senior country. Why am I putting myself through torture listening to Alan Colley? Please, Clifford is the best of this generation. He's not the GOAT.
Ah, stop.
He's
who
not
is?
The GOAT, says an unnamed texter.
Who is?
Ooh, I don't know. Who is an unnamed texter? I would hazard to say that I would agree with you that he is absolutely the GOAT, considering.
I think there's a lot more people who would agree with me than the texter, I'd say. That one.
Great win for Cork Camogie as well. Fantastic win this weekend. We'll be covering all that in detail on Wednesday show with Aoife Murray. Okay, let's get stuck into Gaelic games. Or unless, did you have a low light, Hossan? No, it was all positive. We're all very, very positive.
Yeah,
today,
no, absolutely.
Which I'm having. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, we're all in a good space.
That's a good space to be. Right, Alan, you're sticking around. We're going to chat football a little bit later on. We will be chatting Lions Rugby with Neil Tracy, but we're going to take a very short break and then dive into to Kerry's victory over Donegal in detail with Austin O'Malley. Now, you're very welcome back to the show as we chat Gaelic games in detail with Austin O'Malley. Was there ever a doubt in this result? When you look 13 points to 4 before the 20th minute, it was always going to end up as a Kerry victory when you saw how it started.
Yeah, like look at I think when Kerry looked back and when we all look back on it, like that opening salvo where Kerry just absolutely came out of the blocks with such intent and such industry and such energy, and like, you know, kind of a typical of as I said, of maybe a Jack O'Connor team in finals, that, you know, it was clear that they were really, really going for it and that they had really, really targeted that opening, like, you know. And I suppose Gavin White really set the tone and the tempo straight away from the throw-in, where he absolutely knifed through Donegal and offloaded to the corner forward who clipped it over, and Keeney. So like, I just thought from there on they just absolutely dominated that first sort of opening 20 minutes. They've been 13-4 up, but I always thought watching it, I was thinking like, Donegal, they're going to come with something. But like, I know we said at the outset, so it was a tactical masterclass from Kerry in terms of, you know, they, and we spoke maybe Friday evening about, you know, killing sort of Donegal's key pillars. Like they very much pressed up and, you know, cracked Patton's kick out. Like they were hoovering up even the secondary stuff, breaking ball. It was just literally like, it was blue jerseys were hoovering this up. They took an awful lot of the air. I think the most impressive thing for me that, you know, it was a very, very clever tactic. They built a lot of slow phases in terms of managing the ball and moving Donegal around. That back six and seven and eight that Donegal had dropped in, moving them around. They never gave them an opportunity to get those double ups and triple ups. They were so clean and clinical, their handling, moving it, you know, and they were they were literally draining energy out of Donegal, and they didn't give Donegal the oxygen or the energy with those cheap turnovers. And Donegal's, their whole game is based on transitions, and they just never got going. They never got the guys into the game, their legs or their running power. And that was just it was a really, really powerful opening 20 minutes, and that set the tone. Donegal looked mentally, I thought, they looked frayed. You could see, and you're always looking maybe from signals of teams, and I always think, like, you know, misplaced passes and handling errors are always an indication that you're mentally off, you know. And you could see Kerry, you know, plucked a number of those. There was a couple of there, David or Paddy Clifford got on in terms of interceptions, and they got scores on the other end. And, you know, there was just a lot of what you would say un-Donegal like turnovers. Even the Michael Murphy free, you know, 23 or 21 minutes, hitting the post and coming back out. They just looked off it. But I think it was basically down to, they were a little bit shell shocked, it looked like, at the start, you know.
Didn't have an answer. From the mental side of things, with that professionalism in your background, talk to me about this breaking away from the parade and all that. Is there much in that?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. I was looking at it, and obviously, I suppose, coming into a game like that, you're trying to control as much as you can. And what I can only assume was that was premeditated. We break here, that again, that signalling that we're in control of this, we're doing our own thing. They also broke away, obviously, from, which was an interesting one, from the actual president's handshake. By the time he got to the end of it, they broke away, done another little bit of activation stuff. Took their time.
Theory on that, Austin, yeah, took even their time from watching it, because I think, and in their defence on that, Shane, yeah, it took too long.
Yeah.
The handshake's too long. We were timing it up. It was 3.5-4 minutes. And lads are after warming up. Then you're standing up waiting for the handshake.
The parade was shortened, and the exact same thing happened in the hurling final, yeah, as well.
And then they went back to trying to, just to get themselves going again, yeah, wasn't it? They went back, yeah, to that little activation thing, as Austin said. And then they got themselves into the parade. And I think, to be fair to them, now whether it was psychological or not, but for me looking in, I thought they broke away to just do another little kind of,
so it was more physical than mental,
a little warm up thing,
yeah,
again.
Yeah, because there was, like, it was, it took quite a long time, as you said, for them to go back in. And I suppose, you know, in your preparation, you're trying to be meticulous in terms of every minute and so on, and to make sure that guys don't get cold and cool down, and that they're ready for that start. But I suppose on the counter of that, I thought it was interesting. Kerry didn't miss a beat in the march. They went right around, and they looked very, very controlled and composed. And they just seemed to be unaffected by it. So, yeah, I'm sure it was premeditated, and it was obviously trying to manage every sort of second and minute to make sure lads are ready for a really, really quick start.
Would Jimmy Guinness do anything differently in hindsight if he was setting up again?
Yeah, I think he would, and I suppose that's the value in having the game back. You know, there's a lot to root over, the embers of this, and in particular, I suppose we even spoke about off air. I suppose the most glaring one is that, you know, the statistics that come out afterwards, that Paddy Clifford handled the ball 76 times in terms of possession
with no turnovers,
which
is just ridiculous.
There was no one near him.
Yeah, to run that amount of leather up in your hands is incredible. But he is an artist as well. And in the way he conducted things, he's such a good ball carrier. He's so clever. There was times where he was just literally like it was cat and mouse. He was playing with Donegal defenders, you know, getting them to bite in so he could offload. And his vision is extraordinary. So, he literally conducted everything. The amount of stuff that went through him and he knitted and obviously little passages with David and how productive he was. I think if they had it back, and I thought going into it, when you were thinking about matchups, I thought that they were going to maybe push Ryan McHugh up on him, someone that's really experienced that might get a grip on him. But you can see the counter to that where they say maybe they take a lot away from their own transitional game then, because Ryan McHugh is quite a, you know, a big one on that. Yeah, the other one I suppose that you're looking back on again is, you know, they did remain zonally in there, and Donegal, you know, picked them off around. So maybe, like, looking back on it, was there a change up or a plan where we go man to man and try and fight it that way? But
Would you change at mid game? Because in the beginning he was on the RTGA podcast and he mentioned that zonal defence would win you 80 or 90% of games. You're just coming up against the GOAT, if we're gonna call David Clifford that. Along with Paddy and Sean and Gavin White and Joe Connor and all these just tremendous players that are just getting to grips with a new game and able to just break at you quick.
They are, and it was so evident early on what they were doing, and even listening to Paddy Clifford afterwards, like that they decided, and management obviously had them back, that they will pick them open because they have the artists and they have the skill set and they have the finishers to do that. So that's why, like, Kerry were so patient in terms of the way they moved them around and really got off really, really good and clever shot. So, like, I know it's all okay to say you change midstream, but if you haven't been drilling that type of system all year, and in fairness, Donegal have been very process orientated. Like, and the one thing about Donegal, I think, is when you do analyse them, you know exactly what you're getting, and that's a massive strength from them because it's so well drilled and it's so formulaic, and it's very easy in terms of the formula to run it again. But when you come up against the likes of Kerry, who are, you know, have that type of skill set and talent and have that sort of, you know, instinct and industry.
You said it a minute ago, Austin, and even watching it. For the likes of that, Shane, what you're saying, they were so clean and clinical. Austin said a minute ago about the couple of handling errors, and there was a couple. Gallen had one out on the right in the first half, and even Michael Murphy played a blind pass and it got intercepted. Little things like that. Every possession, the two words for it, they were so clean and clinical. There was no dropping balls. There was no, and those small details matter so much, Shane, that if you're not dropping a ball, if you're able to catch it when it's given to you and you're able to move it on as quickly to the next fella, like, it's very hard for defenders, in fairness to them. The couple of ones I thought as well, Austin, where I think, and everybody thought, oh, Jim is going to come up with this master plan. We didn't see it. It needs to be said, we didn't see it. But the biggest one and the most glaring one for me was with the Paddy thing. Because David's going to score at least six. At least. He got nine in the end, right? I think you'd nearly allow for that if you're stopping what's going on out the field. And if you're stopping the source, he might not even get the nine. But Paddy was literally running the show. Like, it was unbelievable, Shane, when I was watching. And the other couple of ones I thought as well, just my own view watching it, because they were poor on the kick out, was he didn't start McFadden, who's good at the kick outs, winning ball for them and breaking ball as well. And the other lad that he started, I thought, had a poor game, McGonagall, along with Langham, was poor in midfield. But the big lad that came on, number 26, McGee, was very good when he came on and made a big difference. So I think he might look back on, and look, it's easy in hindsight to look back and say, I should have played this fella, I should have played that fella.
But on the flip side of that, if you mark Paddy, then okay, you might give David a bit of freedom. Sean O'Shea comes into the match, then you have to mark Sean O'Shea then, and then all of a sudden you've four markers or who?
Well, if it takes that chain, especially on Paddy and David. Well, David was just, your man was marking him anyway, so that was fine. But it was the ball that was coming into him. Paddy was giving it into everyone. It wasn't just David.
But that circles back then to Enda McGinley's point of the zonal defence will win you a match 80-90% of the time. Okay, it didn't when push came to shove.
But can you, Austin, hear from a manager's point of view? So what Shane is saying there, if you take, so they took David out, so then it becomes 10v10 effectively. If you put someone out on Paddy and then it's 9v9, can you still mark on his own 9v9?
Well, you have to drop off a little bit. Like, well, you could, you can still drop off, but I suppose within Croke Park, you are, given what you're up against, like within Croke Park, that space, like it is, like with your zone, everybody has a set, obviously, zone, and there's a way to, obviously, even your body position within that in terms of what you're, the way you're facing and the way you're cutting off angles and all of that. When you start plucking bits and pieces out of that, then that's where you begin to open yourself up and there's serious goal threats. Like, so, like, obviously, with Clifford going to that box 10, it pulled a little bit more attention to there.
But that's the point. You're saying there's goal threats, which I get because obviously there's more space. But if you're stopping the fella who's going to create the goal threats.
Yeah. 100%, like, and this is what we're probably going back to, that if they did have a back, I think they would push someone up on Paddy. But again, you can't, like, the other guys that are around him in terms of Shawnee, in terms of Gainey, like.
But I don't think they're, not taken away from them, they're good, obviously they're very good, Shawnee, but he was the man. Like, Paddy was the man.
No, it's a very valid point. Are we reading too much into the defeat to Meath? Was that a major shot in the arm, or was it just an off day and this Kerry team were always just developing?
Yeah, I think, look, it wasn't, they would say it themselves, and they have come out and said it, they were off it in terms of particularly their energy and their application was off. But also, when that result came in and I was looking through, I was saying they were down quite a significant number of players, guys that are big, big leaders, the likes of Jim McCall, you know, Paddy and these guys, Breen O'Begley, like Mikey Breen, these are all big pieces of the jigsaw, you know. And like me, they're a hell of a good side, you know, and they were in a groove and they caught them. All the big teams were caught when you look through the season. So like, it has worked to their advantage. They definitely had to go back and reset, and they found a lot. Obviously, they come under a hell of a lot of criticism after that, and they had to sort of, you know, sort of close ranks and circle the wagons. And you know, there are moments like that in seasons, you know, that it's about how you use them. And I thought Kerry used it really, really well. And going back to Jack O'Connor, I think, you know, he obviously felt the criticism and felt quite hurt by it. And I thought it was interesting because Jack is generally quite very measured. But I thought he came out fighting after the Armagh game. And I just thought, if I was a player in the group, you know, it would be very easy for Jack maybe to back away from that and have the victories out. But I thought, if you're a player in the group and you see your manager, you know, really fighting for you and really calling it out, I thought that probably had a more galvanising effect from them as well. And I'd say they drew great energy from that. And, you know, it's still clearly a sore point. Even listening to Paddy Clifford yesterday, you know, he said, we were disrespected. We're disrespected, you know, they were called a one-man band and so on. So that was definitely used as an agency inside to draw a little bit more.
That was massive, I think, Shane. Going back to that meeting was a blessing in disguise, because... And Austin's 100% right. If you're a player in the dressing room and you're the manager, and he's not coming out against journalists, he's coming out against one of the star players, because it was effectively Dar O'Shea's article that he was coming out against. So for him to be standing up against someone with the profile of Dara in the county, and the players are saying, okay, this is our manager backing us, we're going to give it everything we have for him now. And they played with a bit of fire in the belly after that, I thought. Like Sean O'Shea, who's so elegant and brilliant on the ball, works hard. But he played, even yesterday, he's given it to fellas, like he played with an anger.
Yeah, they were really combative.
It would be peak Kerry Yerra-ism if that was all, you know, preordained.
Now you got us thinking.
Who knows? Right, championship is over. The new rules, when you reflect on it, Austin, there was a bit of criticism throughout the league campaign, not so much in the championship, I think it's fair to say. What tweaks would you make, or are you pleased with what you've seen to date? I know there are a couple of sandboxes games to come and it's not completely ratified, but where do you stand on it at the moment?
I think by and large it's got a really good road test now, and I think teams have you know, they've really gone about, you know, embracing them, and managers and coaches. And I think it has obviously freshened up everything from a player's perspective. I think from a coaching perspective, it's freshened up everybody's mindset around the game as well, in terms of offering you different opportunities to coach in a different way and to be innovative and creative. So I think by and large it has been a huge success. There are still maybe, and in fairness to them, you know, they left that little bit of a mechanism within the system that they altered and changed a couple of things as it goes. The only one that really kind of maybe I thought at maybe still needs to look at is that one where you can take the ball back outside the you know, for a two-pointer on a free. And I still think that's it's a heavy penalty for a minor incursion that's somewhere else. But everything else, I think, I would be a fan of. I think in terms of it has created great sort of 1v1 situations where we're beginning to see, you know, our top forwards like David Clifford, like the Conor Callans and these guys, you know, weave their magic. We're still seeing, and we're seeing more brilliant 1v1 defending, and you're looking at even like players like young Rafferty, Mead fullback, yeah. You know, these are guys that would have largely had big numbers dropped back around them, and they've been a piece in the jigsaw, more so. But they're actually out and out 1-on-1 defenders. Even the likes of, you know, Finbar Rorty and Brendan McCall, we've seen some great defensive 1v1 stuff, and that's going back to the old school, you know, because a lot of these guys and a lot of the systems that were played up to this, you drop 15 back and you were marking a box of space. And, you know, I've like from a coaching perspective, it's very easy to do that, you know. And you've often, even in training, often, before this even happened, you'd play where you'd left 1v1 and your lads would be going like, we're wide open, you know. And you say, well, you got to deal with that. But I think that's been really, really, and the transitional nature as well. So I think it's brought so much to the game. And I think Alan, even in there yesterday, looking like, I mean, that's, yesterday was the blue ribbon. It was the showpiece of, you know, and it was the end point of the whole season. And I think it's been a success.
Oh, massively, Austin. Like, even the excitement amongst people yesterday. And I know you had the two best teams and you'll have excitement on all Ireland final day anyway. But just in terms of what they were all kind of anticipating, what could break out in front of them. A game, like, of scores, yeah, and all the action and all the things that we've seen all season. So Jim Gavin and his team around him, they've really kind of ramped things up. It's been phenomenal.
Absolutely brilliant stuff. Okay. Austin O'Malley, thank you. Not only for today, but indeed throughout the championship. We're going to have to get you back in on Mondays anyway, even if there's no football to talk about.
Just to keep
the man beside you honest.
Just keep him honest. You need someone. An old co-pilot. Yeah.
Listen, Austin O'Malley, thank you very much. Alan, you're sticking around to chat football. But up next, we're chatting rugby with Neil Tracy.
This is 2FM. Game on. Rugby.
Now, Neil Tracy joins us from Australia to chat rugby and reflect on Hugo Keenan's heroics as he scored the winning try with the final play of the game to secure a 29-26 win and a series win for the Lions against the Wallabies. High drama in Melbourne. Neil, what was the atmosphere like at the MCG? A good venue for rugby?
Oh, Shane, it was absolutely incredible. I've been lucky enough over the last few years to get to some great stadiums and great games doing this job, but I'd have to say the MCG on Saturday was right up there and probably a good shout of it being the best stadium and the best atmosphere I've experienced and an all round occasion. You're talking what, a 100,000 stadium. It was just over 90,000 full on Saturday, and I would say easily 40,000 to 45,000 Lions supporters. There was red jerseys all over the place in Melbourne on Saturday afternoon. Relatively slow kind of making their way into the city earlier on in the week because there had been such a huge amount of them in Brisbane. Obviously, the various tour groups went off and did a few days here and a few days there, but by Saturday and Friday, the city was just thronged with red jerseys, red hats, red bags, red whatevers. And I think it was so important as well that the game itself, the venue and the spectacle got the game it deserved, because coming in after last week in Brisbane, there were fears that the tour was kind of going to fizzle out and run out of steam. And the grand spectacle of 90,000 supporters at one of the most iconic stadiums in the world, let alone in Australia, just wasn't really going to have the test match that it ought to have. And boy, did we get it. Australia blitzing the Lions in the space of 10 minutes, scoring 3 tries in that first half. And the stadium absolutely erupted. And all of a sudden, by halftime, it was back down from an 18-point game to a 6-point game. And from that kind of gunslinging first half, we ended up having a really tense and an edgy second half, which, as we kind of saw in the end, had an incredible finish.
Where has that been all this time from Australia? This power, this talent that they have, because they've been misfiring. This under a bit of a rebuild under Joe Schmidt. You add to the fact the 6-2 bench split backfired when they lose their winger early on. So where's this hunger been?
Certainly I would say they really, really dug around into what was being said in the media in the last week. I don't think you can feed off that every week. You can kind of run yourself out, I think, very quickly emotionally if you're to do that. But I think someone like Joe Schmidt, he's a very emotionally intelligent coach, and I would say he picked that week and the few days leading up to that second test where people were talking about how Australia were bullied. They were completely beaten up front in that first half in Brisbane a week ago. And obviously, there's the obvious stuff of they were bringing Will Skelton back into the team. They were bringing Rob Valentini back into their team. Probably their two most powerful forwards. Valentini, arguably their best ball carrier. And the impact the two of them had was enormous in those first 40 minutes. They got on the ball so much. You can even see, if you go back and watch it, in the first 2 minutes, there's two lineouts in the opening 2-3 minutes of the game. And on each one of those lineouts, you can see how the Wallabies manufacture space for Skelton and for Valentini to get the ball into space. So for the first one, they get players running towards the back of the lineout, and Will Skelton comes up the front and takes it there and manages to get an offload away, and they break down the near touchline. On the second one, down towards the Lions 22, they throw a ball over the top and Valentini takes it and he carries his way 10, 15 yards forward. So they were very, very clever at manufacturing space for their best players to get onto the ball. But the problem was that they probably weren't fully fit. And I think Schmidt probably did very well to get 40 odd minutes out of each of them. Valentini went off at halftime. That wouldn't have been part of the plan. He's very much an 80 minute player when he's playing. Skelton goes off after 46 minutes. Clearly they were absolutely spent after the time they had on the pitch, and you knew it was going to be a long half an hour for them after that.
Johnny Sexton mentioned at halftime that ill-discipline cost them some big carries and the Lions are bullied. Was there a level of complacency in some form because the Lions tour as a whole hasn't been that challenging?
I'm not sure if it's that, but they definitely were very, very sloppy early on. And it has been, they have started slowly in quite a few games over this tour, particularly when it comes to discipline. They've given away a lot of penalties. I'm pretty sure they conceded 6 penalties in the open 24 minutes on Saturday evening. And I don't have it right in front of me. I'm almost certain they finished with 9. So you can see how they kind of cleaned up their act. And even speaking to Andy Farrell after the game, we asked him about, what were the confidence levels like at 23-5 behind? And he said he was still very, very confident because he knew that Australia didn't have to work particularly hard to get those 3 scores very, very quickly. They were all coming off poor discipline, poor mistakes from the Lions. And once they cleaned those up and just started to be a little bit more efficient, things started to work out for them.
Right, time to get technical, Neil, here. I know you're a rugby nerd, you're a rugby expert. Were the Lions fortuitous with some of the referee decisions? Firstly, Sheehan's try, because Ronan O'Gara on commentary said immediately, you can't do that. Interestingly, Sky didn't go back for a follow-up to Ronan. But explain the issue here and where do you stand?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is one of the areas where World Rugby haven't really cleared up this issue. It's kind of happened a couple of times before, so obviously you can't jump into a tackle or jump over a tackle, but you can dive in the process of scoring a try. So there's a very, very grey area in rugby's laws, and it kind of just comes down to a referee's interpretation of if he's deeming that, like in this situation with Dan Sheehan, he's technically he is jumping over a player, but he's also diving in the process of trying to score a try. It's a very, very hard one to say, did he get it right or wrong? Because you can look at the law book and you can find the answer to suit whatever argument you want to have. So I think you can kind of side with Piardi on that one. I know Joe Schmidt didn't, but when it comes to it, it just is a very, very complex situation with a lot of grey in it. And I think Dan Sheehan was probably the smartest man in the stadium to know that.
And then you mentioned people quoting the law book. People have been quoting Law 9.2 online and on Twitter about the clear out at the end that led to the try. Should it have been penalised?
At the time, I went on Saturday Sports with Joanne on Saturday, and I kind of sat on the fence on it because really you're scrambling to file a match report and you were getting quick glances up at the big screen in the stadium, and it was really hard to see the intricacies of where the connection was made and where the hit was. But having watched it back a good few times over the last couple of days, I do actually think the referee did get it right. I think if you look at it, it's hard to see. It looks more likely that Jack Morgan hit Carlo Tozzano like high up on the back rather than the neck itself. So I think he did get it right, to be totally honest. And I think what doesn't look good from Carlo Tozzano's point of view is the theatrics afterwards, where he falls backwards and he's holding his head. Now, if I think you could be generous to say that if there was contact on the neck, it certainly wasn't on the head. And, I think it was very obvious he was trying to milk that penalty. What I will say, though, is this is not going away in Australia. This is like their version of our Thierry Henry handball back in 2009. Just scanning through some of the back pages yesterday, the Sunday Telegraph in particular went strong. The headline, robbed, Wallabies shattered as referee ruins our shot at history with series deciding missed penalty. So they're not sitting on the fence on that one, the Sunday Telegraph. But no, it's a story that's not going to go away. Joe Schmidt was quite critical of the match officials straight after the match. Phil Waugh, the CEO of Rugby Australia, in the last day or so as well, has backed Schmidt on that and says they're going to be seeking a clarification from World Rugby. Personally, though, I think he got the decision right.
Will they harness that hurt now for the third test, and will we expect to see many changes from a Lions point of view?
In terms of changes, that one's going to be really tough to figure out. The Lions didn't do media today. They took an extra. They gave the players and staff an extra day off. They're going to regroup on Tuesday morning and get back to work then. So it'll be Tuesday afternoon before we hear anything from the coaches. It's very tricky to figure out, will they want to make changes? Because they made a big deal about how they don't want to win a test series 2-1. They want to win a 3-0. It's 121 years since the Lions last swept Australia in a three-game series, going back to 1904. They haven't won all tests on one tour since 1927 in Argentina. So there's an enormous amount of history at stake this weekend. And if they were to go and win a series 3-0, they would, you know, they would be writing themselves into the history books. But then on the flip side, from maybe Andy Farrell's point of view, you're thinking there's an opportunity here to show a bit of loyalty to some players who haven't really got a massive crack in the Lions tour so far. You look at Alex Mitchell, who didn't get off the bench last weekend. He got a couple of minutes in the first test. What an opportunity might it be for him to get a start ahead of Jamison Gibson Park. But at the same time, why would you take someone like Gibson Park out of the team, who's been fantastic? From a purely just a biased Irish point of view, you look at someone like Josh van der Fleer, who hasn't got any action in the test series so far, and a world player of the year just a couple of years ago, and one of Farrell's most trusted soldiers from an Irish point of view as well. So there are a lot of players who'll be looking to get a sniff back into the test side as well, and throw into the mix Joe McCarthy and Mac Hansen, who we're still unsure about when it comes to their injuries. From the Wallabies' point of view, they've got a couple of big games coming up against South Africa. I would say that game on Saturday took an enormous physical toll out of them. So while it would be very disappointing to see Joe Schmidt maybe casting one eye towards a couple of big games against the Springboks in a few weeks, you can't really rule it out either.
Just before I let you go, Neil, Jack Conan mentioned Katie Taylor message or video before the test. What's the detail on that?
He just casually dropped it into conversation that it was very, very special for him as a Bray man last week that the squad got a message of support from Katie Taylor. I think she sent a video into the camp or something like that was played out. And the connection would be through Gary Keegan, who's the performance coach for the Lions. And obviously he would have worked with Katie Taylor for a long time in his previous life with boxing. So that's the connection essentially. But yeah, I think the teams get messages and they get guest speakers in. They also had Martin Johnson in last week, the 1997 and 2001 captain, in presenting the jerseys. And Katie Taylor was just another one of those last week. And you could see what it meant to Conan, who he's always talking about how much he loves being a Wicklow man. You know, people kind of, I think with a lot of these players, people assume that they are from Leinster or they are from Dublin and even a particular part of Dublin. But he's a proud Wicklow man, a proud Bray man. And he was clearly delighted to get that message, because he just came out and told us, no one asked him about it. And it clearly meant a lot to him.
Brilliant. Great stuff. Listen, Neil Tracy, thanks so much for joining us from Australia. It's been a cracking couple of tests, and here's hoping for more of the same at the weekend.
Game on. Swimming.
Now, just before we finish up chatting football, some swimming news. Mona McSharry was unable to replicate her performance in the heats of the 100-metre breaststroke in the semi-finals at the World Aquatics Championships in Singapore, finishing fifth and missing out on a place in the final. In the morning session, the Sligo woman clocked an impressive 1 minute 5.99 seconds, her sixth fastest time ever, and the leading time of all the qualifiers for the semi-finals. Ellen Walsh finished in eighth in the 200-metre individual medley final in a race won by Summer McIntosh. Evan Bailey produced a display of his life in the Worlds with National Centre Limerick swimmer equaling Jack McMillan's 200 metre freestyle. Irish record Danielle Hill opened her championships with a 100 metre breaststroke, finished fifth in her heat, 18th overall, and John Short saw his qualification bid in the 100 metre backstroke end in the heats as he clocked 54.26 to finish in ninth.
Game on. Association football.
So good morning for the Sligo swimmer Mona McSharry. The Sligo man Alan Colley is still with us to chat football. What did you make of the Women's Euros final, Al?
I think, to be fair to England, Shane, they showed a lot of character, not just in that game, but it was a feature of the tournament, because when you think of how far they were not how far, but how many times they fell behind in the tournament.
They rode their luck.
Let's just say. But a lot of that, yeah, there is a bit of luck involved in that, but there's lot of resilience, a lot of character amongst that group as well, to be fair to them, Shane. And even tonight against Sweden when they went two down, that was the one that really stuck out for me. The character they showed, Lucy Bronze, typified all that, getting the goal to get them back in the game. Then they eventually got to the penalty shootout and she took the penalty as well. Almost like a Stuart Pearce type moment. It really was. Mm. Like, yeah, that's inspirational stuff like that. And I think that so much credit must go to the manager as well, because what she's achieved now, not just with England, the Netherlands as well, like, it's incredible her record, Shane. It really is. So I think she deserves enormous amount of credit, as do the players. Spain will be disappointed, but as I said, that second half when England were fighting back and got themselves back in the game, it looked like they were going to go on to win the game. Spain had a spell towards the end of normal time where they got a little bit of control of the game back. Once it went to extra time, extra time kind of has played out like a lot of them in the tournaments, and it was a long slog.
Very cagey.
A month's football as well, like, and the amount of games, and England went to extra time a lot more than the other teams as well, and more so than Spain. So I just felt it kind of had penalty shootout written all over it. And then Chloe Kelly, to be fair to her, stood up again.
Unbelievable.
Like, yeah. Like all the big moments, like, you're talking about big moments for different occasions. She's anything that she's asked, has been asked to do, and any big moment she stood up, to be fair to her.
She thanked her doubters after. She said, "Thanks for all the criticism."
Yeah, I've seen a lot of her on social media.
I don't like much.
I don't like to see a lot of that stuff, Shane. Yeah, Chloe should just rein it in a little bit. Be a little bit more like the Cliffords, Chloe.
Two men, not many words.
Yeah,
to
be a little
be
bit
fair.
More like the Cliffords.
England deservedly European champions.
Deservedly. Well, they have, I suppose, the ones that are the last ones.
Where they
the best
heads
team.
Above.
I think Spain are the best team, technically. We all know that. But that's not always kind of
how finals are decided.
Characteristics in a game. There's a lot more than just technically as well. And as I said, so much of it comes down to your energy and your character and your resilience and all that team spirit that they would have had over a long period of time as well, Shane. Mm. And that's not easy to maintain when you're on the go a long time with the same group. She's been very loyal to those players. Sometimes that can kind of backfire as well against you. But I think she got the blend right in terms of when she was making the substitutions as well, particularly the young girl who was obviously came out of nowhere. She probably didn't even expect to be in the tournament, and then she ended up winning young player of the tournament, young Ajimang, who was fantastic in the games as well. So I do think a lot of it comes down to the manager. She's been fantastic, Serena Wiegmann, and interestingly enough, her assistant who's been there with her all the time, he's gone off now to take over the Netherlands. So I think overall it was a great tournament as well, Shane. Like, even the ticket sales, the interest, Switzerland getting through the knockout round was big.
Record viewing figures, attendance is smashed, I think 22 or 24 group games sold out.
Brilliant,
so
brilliant. It really was.
It's redefining expectations for women's tournament football.
Yeah, well, I think to be fair, like when I suppose the trajectory that it's on, you think at some point, where is it going to kind of plateau out? It still seems to be on the rise, which is great. They've obviously a long way to go in terms of the development, but technically you can see them getting better and better. I think the penalty kicks need to improve a little bit. That was a feature of the tournament as well. But that's, as I said, it's still very much, when you think of, I suppose, and people shouldn't be comparing it to men's football, because that's obviously been around hundreds of years, whereas the women's football in terms of the professionalism isn't. So I think it needs to be allowed time to kind of develop as well. But every tournament I've covered over the last 3-4 years, and obviously heavily involved in this one, I've seen marked improvements. And the one area, like, even Shane, if you wanted one example, the goalkeeping. People used to criticise the goalkeeping. You look at some of the goalkeepers now.
Anne Katrin Berger.
Brilliant. Anne Katrin Berger. She's our favourite. But not just in terms of saving the ball as well. Distribution for the modern game that, we speak a lot about with the men's teams and goalkeepers who are very good playing out from the back. You see that in the women's game as well. So they're constantly developing as well, which is always good to see. But I thought overall it was a really, really good tournament, Shane, I have to say.
Briefly, player of the tournament in your opinion?
Bonmati. Yeah. Bonmati's the Clifford of women's football.
On that,
the David Clifford, not the party.
So the second best. Alan Colley, thank you as always. We'll speak to you again on Friday. Game On is back tomorrow from 6 o'clock. The new music show is up next, so do not go anywhere here until then. Massive thank you to Gary Moran, who produced this evening's programme. Our broadcast coordinator was Laura Lee Davis. From me, Shane Dawson, and all of the Game On team, have a great evening. We're going to check in with the news desk, and then Bennett Silva will take you through the new music show. Bye bye.